Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
Looking for love in places, regrets what I find instead. Looking for full completeness, searching for you. All that I really wanted was peace deep down in my soul. All that I really needed was your love, 'cause your love is all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. Your love is all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need.
I've been spending a lot of time with college students here at The Table who are in transition. They're heading back to school. They're thinking about their last year of school. They're wondering what they're going to do when they finish with this time. And so I've been kind of revisiting some of my own experiences of that as I've sat with them. And I began to realize as I came back from a semester in Northern Ireland and then a summer in Central America right before my senior year, that I didn't care so much about the classes that I was in. I just wanted to change the world. That's where I was when I was 21, 22. And so instead of going to graduate school, I applied to something called the Lutheran Volunteer Corps. And I went to live together with six other people in South Minneapolis. And each of us worked at a different social service agency or an organization doing community organizing and trying to find ways to be part of a movement for social justice in our own lives. And we all worked in different places full time. And we committed to exploring spirituality, to working for social justice, and to living intentionally together. As we did that, we had a small stipend that helped us with food and things like that, and we had health insurance, all of these things that so many folks don't have access to, we were able to take for granted. So it was, that was how we came together. And I was assigned to work in refugee resettlement. And so on my very first day, I've shared before about this, my very first day, I got in a van with Ben and we drove out to the airport and we welcomed a family of Somali refugees. They were a family of 16, Abdi Hudli Hassan and his wife and their 13 kids, and one of those had a child. And it was a profound and incredible experience. And then at the end of that year, most of the folks that I was working with in resettlement were coming from Somalia. And then this is Ethiopia. It's kind of divided up. Ethiopia, as some of you might know, has always been a contested space. All of this during the Cold War, these lines were drawn and colonialism like set in. And instead of having communities that fit around the Amharic and the Tigray and the Oromo people, we created other lines that we called nation states. And so they've been at civil war for so, so long. And that, along with famine, resulted in refugees fleeing their lands and then living in refugee camps. This next image is one of those refugee camps. That's Kakuma, where so many refugees continue to live and did live. This was, this was back in 99, 2000. And after my year working in refugee resettlement, I was asked to stay on board full-time for 1 year to help begin a pilot program to resettle refugees who are HIV positive. And there were 6 sites that were selected around the country to try to do this. And so we got to be one of those, and we were going to resettle 20 HIV-positive refugees and their families. I wanted to change the world, and at moments it felt like we really were. The first of the families that came, folks that were HIV-positive, they appeared healthy. And so it just felt just like every other family. There were all these complications, but we just kind of moved through them. And then the first person that I resettled, that as soon as he got off the plane, you knew that he was living with HIV and AIDS. His name was Ahmed, and Ahmed was my age. We're both 20. I was 22. He was 23. We're both almost 6 feet tall. I was weighing maybe 190, and he was weighing like 115, soaking wet. And the day after he arrived in Minneapolis, I got a phone call that he was not doing well at the apartment that he was in. So I went over. He'd lived in Kakuma for 7 years, this family. And I went to his place, and we went immediately to Hennepin County Medical Center. And there, a nurse pulled the curtain around us, and I only speak English and some enough Spanish to get in trouble, not enough to get out of trouble. He speaks Oromo, he speaks Somali, he speaks Arabic, and he speaks Russian, but we kind of just had to sit there with hand gestures. And they gave us a gown, they gave him a gown, and so he's in this vulnerable place already, and he, before the physician came in, he lifts his arm up to show me where he's in pain, in the most pain. And it's under his left arm. It's like between like a golf ball and a tennis ball size abscess that's there. And so we were these two 20-something young guys that were just sitting on this tile floor. I was there, and then he just kind of collapsed onto the floor. And so we just wept. Sometimes you don't have to have words to just enter into that space. Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, cries, "My joy is gone, grief is upon me, my heart is sick." And in a way that I don't know that I'd ever experienced before, that's what I felt on the floor at HCMC in the emergency room. Ahmed was a reminder for me of how the whole world suffers and it's falling apart. And 1 John 4:8 reminds us that God is love. And so for me, as I was trying to explore spirituality, I don't know that I knew a lot, but what I knew was that if Christianity was going to matter at all to me, it needed to have something to say about Ahmed and me on the floor in Hennepin County Medical Center. And if it didn't, I was pretty convinced that it wasn't worth our time. So our hope is that over these next 3 weeks, we are not going to run away from those stories, but to hold them and to try to discern together how we can reclaim Christianity as a school for love that helps us to engage the truth, the realities. Like this morning, I got here at 6 a.m. and a young 18-year-old kid was sleeping outside right over there, just right outside of our social hall. So instead of working on finishing the sermon, we had some coffee and some breakfast. And the church needs to figure out how to help us as a community love each other better so that that isn't happening for so many people in this community. And so we're going to do that by looking together. We're using this. It's a book by professor at Duke. His name is Norman Wurzba, and it's called Way of Love, and we're going to allow that, I hope, to shape the way that we think about church as a school for love and try to live together in this school as students. And last week, we tried to just hear the challenge of what does it mean for church to be a school of love? Because for a lot of us, that's not what we taught church or have ever been taught church was. So we had to just start with, hey, the purpose of church should be to be a school for love. And so we reminded ourselves of that. And then this morning, I'm going to invite us to kind of evaluate, if this is a school, so what is the curriculum? What is it that we're teaching each other? How are we going to be a school for love? And so I'm going to invite us to revisit that. So what is it that this school of love that we call Christianity teaches? And then try to discern, like, does that matter in our lives? And it does, it has in mine, and I want to share a little bit of that with you this morning. Wurzba describes beautifully what this school of love teaches, and he does it like a professor. So I'm going to invite you into the school of love for a moment in like an academic style. He says that God's love creates a beautiful world, but our distortion and denial of this love leads to life's degradation. God does not give up on us or any creature, and so God works to redirect our waywardness so that we can participate with God in the healing of all life. The goal of God's love is for it to be fully active in the life of each and every creature. And when that happens, life becomes heavenly. So this morning, I'm going to try to invite us into the story of Christianity, the story of God's creating in love, and the story of fallenness that gets interpreted in different ways, and then the hope of redemption, and then the truth of the end of God's story, which is itself hope. And so I'm going to do that by kind of giving us some definitions and frameworks to help us make sense of this. And then I hope I'm going to have flesh on it as I keep coming back to this story of me and Ahmed, because God's story is one that both shapes who we are and then comes to us in the flesh. And so I'm going to try to do both of those things as we journey, and we'll kind of move back and forth from this theoretical idea of Christianity to the emergency room where it gets flesh and bone and reality. Wurzba says that though life was created by God as good and beautiful, made to be nurtured and celebrated, human beings became sinful and thus brought about needless suffering and misery, which now affects the whole world. So he describes sin in a really powerful way for me that I want to invite you to hold. Sin at its core, he says, is the failure of love. Sin isn't simply like bad decisions or a wicked mentality. It can certainly take those forms, he says. And the Apostle Paul went so far as to describe it as a cosmic power that's aligned with the devil that produces evil and destruction. Sin is this disabling force that like locks us in to prisons of fear and anxiety and darkness so that we can't relate to each other, to ourselves in ways that celebrate life. So sin is this failure to love, is when we get caught in a grip that keeps us from celebrating life in ourselves and in the people that are around us. And we fail to love not only because we're wrapped up in our own ambitions, which happens for some of us, but sometimes because we're just consumed by fear. All of these things can like lead us into brokenness, or as the church has described it, as sin. So if love is this optic that enables us to recognize it, then sin is the blinders that keep us from that. So those blinders prevent us from seeing the God-given loveliness, like the hope that is in this young 18-year-old. What I kept telling myself as I went to turn hot water on and he was outside was like, what does it look like if this is Jesus showing up at the doors here? Like, this is where the rubber hits the road, right? What does it look like to be with Ahmed at the emergency room, or in your own office and the person next to you that drives you crazy? Or you're at the gym and that person that thinks like totally different than you do. Like, what does it mean to show up with this and to actually love the people? I'm sometimes really good at saying love, but doing it, that sucks. That's hard. And so I want to take us to Ahmed's story. See, his immediate family members, they were afraid. They were trapped by anxiety and fear. They had false information. They were pretty convinced that if they broke bread together with Ahmed, that they were going to contract HIV too. They were so convinced that they wouldn't even wash their clothes with his clothes, just in case. They wouldn't touch him. And then this was different in every family. Like, there were some families that just welcomed and embraced the person who lived with HIV, and there were other families where the person wasn't. We had to find separate housing. They could not see the belovedness of their own family member. That's what sin does to us. Like, that's what it looks like. It's sin isn't the fear. Fear is real and it happens in us. But it's when we can't move through it and be together in it, that face it, that we end up in broken relationships and we turn away from God and we turn away from people like Ahmed. It's important to look at the harm that we inflict in that way. But I also want to invite us to recognize that sin functions in even deeper ways than just turning away or saying, I'm not going to eat lunch with Ahmed. So I mentioned that we were one of six sites to resettle HIV-positive refugees. That happened because the High Commissioner on Refugees was traveling in East Africa. And what she learned was that there were entire colonies of people who had been drawn together and were living and dying together with HIV/AIDS. And that was happening because part of our policy that we had in place here was that if a family of four, you know, we're going to talk today about baptism, and we're going to have a family of four that's going to sit there, two little kids. That family is applying to come in and be resettled in the United States. As soon as one person in that family tests positive for HIV, the whole family is denied entrance into the United States. That was the policy that we held. And so what happened was that one person over and over would be disappeared. And the High Commissioner on Refugees witnessed this evil and named it as that. Like, this is not okay. And so they started to work together structurally. It's not just that, like, somebody can turn away from Ahmed at a table. We can also turn away from him and his family members through the policies that we set up. And so they worked together to pilot this program to at least try to resettle 120 or so refugees who live with HIV and AIDS. See, fear and misconception about HIV was real. And our government's blanket rejection of this was causing enormous harm. That's a structural sin or structural evil. And sin is always functioning in all of these different ways at the same time. It's this web. And it's not enough then to just love Ahmed when he's standing in front of you, but we have to work on how do we take these fallen structures and redeem them as well. The biblical witness describes it this way. Psalm 52 says, in your hearts you devise wrongs. Your hands deal out violence on earth. Our Christian tradition has a way of helping us think about this, the ways that we're born into this. And we use this fancy theological concept called original sin. And I'm going to try to invite you. Some of you, when you hear the word original sin, when you sang some of the songs that we sang this morning, it was hard. Because a lot of these songs that we start off singing, like, they begin with, I am false, is what Charles Wesley said. I'm a sinner. And for a lot of us, we live in a culture that says, you are good. You are good enough. Everything about you is good. And there's hope in that. Like, I don't want to say it's one way or another, but I want to invite us to try to think a little bit more about why does Christianity say this notion that we're born into sin? Why do we imagine that? Why do we think that we're born into brokenness? And it starts with Paul, and it goes something like this. So there's ways that we interpret Paul. Paul says in Romans 5, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death came through sin, and so death spread to all, because all have sinned. So we take that, and as we always do, we construct whole ways of seeing the world, just around that couple of lines right there. The general notion of original sin, as it gets articulated, goes something like this. God created the world without sin, and then Adam disobeyed God. And then all people who come after Adam are therefore infected with sin and are punished then, or called to be punished by death. That's the way it gets articulated. And Augustine was the most famous and the person who articulated this first. He says that it happens genetically. And so it's like sin passes down from family to family. It's like I pass down something to my daughter genetically, right? And that's one way that it gets thought about. From the very beginning, this has been contested in Christianity. This isn't the only way to think about this. So this is another person named Pelagius, and Pelagius thinks Augustine is nuts. And not only nuts, but like way wrong and couldn't have screwed this up worse. And so Pelagius is afraid that this notion of original sin that Augustine says, like we're all false, I am, is the way we just sang about it. Pelagius says that's wrong. That takes away all of your human responsibility. Like it takes away all of your agency. You have to have agency to do good. And so we have this fight going on in Augustine and Pelagius, and it gets articulated in different ways. Like the songs that we sang. Let's try, I think we have an All Sons and Daughters verse right here. Can you do that next one for me? Will your grace run out if I let you down? That's Pelagius. Pelagius is like, I am going to find a way to like be perfect and good in all these things. And as we do that, I'm going to earn goodness is the way sometimes people, I'm going to earn grace. And folks like struggle with what does this mean and how do we do this? And then there's this other line in the exact same song, because I am a sinner. If it's not one thing, it's another. That's Augustine. Augustine is like, you're a mess. I'm a mess. We're all a mess. But Augustine says, like, God's not a mess, and that's good. That's good. And ironically, like, for those that go with Pelagius and want to focus on our agency, what honestly, ironically and honestly comes into that, though, is this weird sense of shame. So that, like, if I don't do good with Ahmed, if I just send the 18-year-old kid on his way, I do those things, it's like I am broken in all these ways, and it's all, then I just become trapped in my own sense of shame that I'm not good enough for God. And so the church has always struggled with all of this. Like, who are we? And so I want to try to give us a third way to think about original sin that has helped me to kind of not just see this as a polarity, but where we are born into brokenness, it seems to me. And so I want to help us to think about that a little bit. And I want to do it just by bluntly telling you a little bit about Ahmed for a moment and about my story. So I was born in Kansas City with parents who both have, one has a graduate degree and one has a college degree. And they had the freedom to move around this country as they chased their own vocational dreams. And we had the freedom to do just that. Ahmed was born in Oromia. It's a region that we had just seen in Ethiopia to peasant farmers. He didn't make it through high school because there wasn't a social structure in place for him to do that. And then he had to flee from his own homeland because of famine and civil war. That's original sin. Like, we're both 23-year-old guys. I have the healthy structures around me to weigh in at 190, and he comes in at 115 soaking wet. That happens because of the structures that were around us that we were born into. We didn't do anything. We were just born into them, right? Those are huge systems, war and racism and colonialism. They're distortions of our world that we are born into and we ultimately can't control, but we do have some agency and call to try to work on healing. They're passed from those who've gone before us to us. And in that way, I think they are original. That's the way I think about original sin, are these systems and structures that are distorted and twisted and we're born into them. It's the primary way I understand it. Frederick Buechner says it beautifully. Original sin means we all originate out of a sinful world, which taints us from the word go. We all tend to make ourselves the center of the universe, pushing away from the center everything that seems to impede its freewheeling. More even than hunger, poverty, or disease, he writes, it is what Jesus said he came to save the world from, our self-centeredness. The biblical witness in 1 John, again, it says, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth isn't in us. And that's a hard thing to hear in 2016, I think, for a lot of us. So while the Christian worldview reminds us that the world has fallen apart in all of these ways, it also says that that fall is never the end. That fall is never the stopping place. That God's love always meets us in the midst of that and then transforms. God has always and only ever wanted life and love to flourish together, is what Wurzba says. The Bible teaches that from the beginning, God has been at work to heal our diseased ways, mend our brokenness, nurture our need, reconcile our divisions. So God meets our fallenness and then lures us to redemption. Again, John 10 says, I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. So what did that look like in Ahmed's story? Like, what did abundant life or redemption actually look like there in the emergency room at Hennepin County Medical Center? Well, first, on a personal level, he experienced a profound sense of redemption and healing in his own body. This is a person who, for the very first time, was receiving medical care in the United States and started to have the medicines to fight back against the disease that was inside of his very body. So on a personal level, he experienced that, but it always is really a contradiction in terms to say that an individual is healthy, because we're only healthy in community. That's what health really looks like. It's not just this individual thing. It happens, and redemption happens not just in our bodies. It starts sometimes within, but happens as the healing of relationships are around us. So as his body started to heal, so too did some of his relationships with family members and with friends who'd closed the door on him. Instead of eating by himself, I remember going back 4 months later, and for the first time ever, seeing one of his family members sitting at the table with him, being willing to eat injera, is what it's called, eat injera together. Like, that's what redemption looks like as we move through our fears and then we break bread and that fear fades away and love resides again. Redemption also came because that High Commissioner on Refugees looked at a system that created colonies of dying people with HIV and said, that is not okay. That is what evil looks like. And then she started to work with others on how do we structurally address this. And so even now, to this moment, there are obstacles that people with HIV face that are refugees, but we also have, I believe, that love is winning. Like, what's happening in that now is that people can apply for waivers, and then they can be assured that when they come here, we have medical students in the room, folks that are going to meet these folks when they come to the United States, that are going to help that process, because we have new systems in place that say we're going to take our time and we're going to try to work together on this. And those systems always need more redemption and more healing, but the truth is that fallenness is fading away into redemption as well, because from the beginning, God has been at work to heal our diseased ways, to mend our brokenness, to nurture our need, and to reconcile our divisions. And we call that God Emmanuel. We celebrate that at Christmas, and it means God with us, because God is forever desiring to lead us, all of creation, into a fullness of life together. See, in the person of Jesus, God dwells fully embodied and then calls us to a life of healing. That love itself is not coercive. So we have a cross here in the very front of the sanctuary that we come back to. We have that cross because in it we're reminded of the violent forces that try to say love doesn't win. Those are the violent forces that try to say that the embodiment of God's love is going to hang on a cross. And Jesus could have done any number of things in responding to that. And instead of fighting back violence with violence, Jesus absorbs anger and hate and swirls around. And then he counters that. Instead of with more violent force, he takes it within himself. He suffers. And people understand this in various ways. But what I see when I see the cross is this mirror that challenges me to see the truth of the suffering that is around, and that says that redemption and new life comes through that, comes out of that. And so God's love keeps calling us to let go of that grip of sin, that we might live into a redeemed life. I said that after college, I wanted to change the world. And that's where I was stuck. I thought I wanted to change the world. But the Christian story, the story of fall and redemption, reminds me that God's always already been changing the world, leading us to peace. See, after worship this morning, Pastor Linda and I are going to sit right here with families, with parents who are thinking about, is this the story I want to shape my child in? A story that says the reality of brokenness is there in the world and it doesn't have the last word, that God's love is meeting us right in the middle of that and calling us to new life. And some of those parents are going to say, yes, I want to raise my child in that very story, to be in this together with others. And next week, teenagers and adults, we're going to reflect on the same thing, that God's love is never going to let us down, but meets me there as I'm on the floor, the tile floor with terrible lighting over it, with a guy who is showing me an abscess that needs deep healing. And then people come around us as we start to recognize we can all do something to respond and to take part in and get caught up in God's love. I believe that's what it looks like to be a people who are called to follow in this school of love. And we don't just do it through baptism that celebrates our whole lives. We do it every week as we come together around a table. We're going to take bread and juice. And as we do that, we're going to take that into our very bodies to say we want this story to affect our bodies. Because that's how God comes to us in the flesh. And so we're going to practice that together. And then we're going to say that God's story is a story that all are invited to the table. So what's that mean for us? Where's the hurt and the brokenness? Because we're not in the emergency room right now. But the truth is, somebody is. Somebody that you love, somebody that you don't know you're called to love, is there right now. And so we keep coming back to this table to remind us that the kitchen table is actually the desk in this school of love. That's the desk in this school of love. And there are Ahmeds in your life, those that you know and those that you're called to see maybe for the first time. So may we do that now and always. Amen.
Because I am a sinner. If it's not one thing, it's another. Caught up in words, tangled in lies. But you are a Savior, and you take brokenness aside and make it beautiful, beautiful. Will you call me child when I tell you lies? 'Cause all I know is how to cry. If it's not one thing, it's another. Caught up in words, tangled in lies. But you are a Savior, and you take brokenness aside and make it beautiful.